Welcome back, everybody, to BU in the Morning. You're listening to BU in the Morning on WTBU, the beat of Boston University. You can listen at 89.3 FM or 640 AM, BU Cable Channel 6, WTBUradio.org, or the WTBU Radio app. You can't call us just yet, however, because our phone is struggling right now. However, when it's fixed, you can call us at 617-353-6400 and send us a request on the Spinitron. Ladies and gentlemen, listeners, we have made it to the interview. We are joined today by Dr. Catherine Sanderson. She is a professor at the Manuel Family. She is a Manuel Family Professor in Life Sciences at Amherst College. She has a book coming out named The Positive Shift, Mastering Mindset to Improve Happiness, Health, and Longevity. She has spoken all over about self-love, about understanding personalities, social variables, influencing health and behaviors, and she knows what she's talking about. Today, we are joined by Dr. Catherine Sanderson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I appreciate the time.
Of course, of course. So I was reading over the email that was sent to my supervisor, so to speak, and I was reading about these, I call them modules of happiness. I don't want to take over. I don't want to give any verbs to anything that isn't properly what it is. But it says here that we have four different kind of, let's say, avenues of practicing a healthy mindset. One being, you know, practicing gratitude, staying off social media, setting realistic expectations, and knowing that no relationship is effortless. So if do you mind expounding on some of those modules and, you know, kind of giving us some rules, some rules of the road?
Sure, absolutely. And let me start by saying that the real reason that I wrote this book is that I think there is a very common belief that there are some people who are happy in the world and there are some people who are not happy in the world, and happiness is really driven by something like your genetics. You know, you're genetically happy or you're not, or you have particular life circumstances. You know, you won the lottery, you know, you're financially comfortable, whatever, and you're going to be happy, or you've really struggled with some adversity and difficulty, and therefore you're not going to be happy. And the most important message of my book is that no matter where you start on that sort of natural happiness curve, and yeah, there are people who are happier than other people, but we can all do something to increase our happiness. So I actually start the book by describing how I'm not a very happy person. So I'm somebody who struggles to find happiness and has to really work for it. And so the real message that I want people who read the book and who listen to this interview to get from it is that there are all things that are within our control that we can do to increase our happiness. And so those are some examples of things we can do. But the most important message is that do one of them. Do one of them to feel better.
Okay. Okay. I really respect that message. That really ties into my first question, which is happiness a goal that we should strive to meet in our life? Is it something that is transient, that comes and goes? Should we try to latch on to happiness, or should we know that pitfalls happen? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, that's such an important question. I'm so glad you started with that. So I think that it's impossible to imagine that everyone goes through life, you know, feeling joy all the time, right? I mean, we all have the experience of being, you know, stuck in traffic or right, having a disappointing, you know, academic or professional experience or broken relationship. So it's impossible to imagine that we can go through life, you know, sort of feeling great, intense joy and happiness all the time. But I think what's important to remember is that when we think really broadly about happiness, most people who feel happy pretty consistently do so because they have a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives. So that doesn't mean that, you know, they're not bummed when they have to go to the dentist or, you know, don't have anything bad happen to them. But it means that overall they have a sense of their life is worthwhile, their life has purpose and meaning. And I think that's really what we should be striving for.
Okay.
So when college students come into my office and say, hey, what should I major in or what should I do or whatever, the first thing I say is, what's the class you love the most? You know, what's the class that you do all of the reading for first? What's the class that you call home and say, oh my gosh, this professor talked about this, you know, today, it's so interesting. And I think that so often we get caught up in society of saying, well, what's a prestigious career or what's a career that's going to make a lot of money or what's that? And, you know, for some people, those are also super rewarding and meaningful careers. But for other people, they've never actually sat down and sort of said, hey, what do I love? What brings me great excitement and passion? And if you can find that thing in your major, your job, your career, your life, you're going to be happier.
I'm glad that you were talking about majors specifically about the difference between chasing what you love and chasing a dollar sign.
Mm-hmm.
Where would one find their purpose? Do you think that, I know that's a pretty general question, very broad question, but do you think that they should start outward or inward, looking outside for inspiration, going to maybe a friend, maybe a professor, maybe a news article, or should they, you know, hide them, well, not hide, but sort of look deeper inward, finding what, you know, they truly feel inside? What do you think?
I love that question, and this is such an interesting interview because you're really approaching it from such a more practical level than many people, frankly, do. So on a practical level, I'd say two things. I'd say one, think about internally and reflect back. So what did you love in high school? What do you do for free time? You know, what do you do? You know, do you take extreme joy from volunteering or from spending time in nature, you know, or from helping people, you know, talking to friends or giving advice or, you know, being outdoors or whatever it is. So one, I would say, think about what has really excited and interested you in your free time, in your academic work, et cetera. And so that's an inward look. But the other thing I think is really trying to expose yourself, you know, very broadly. So that could mean going to a college lecture. It could be reading the newspaper. It could be talking to family members, you know, friends, et cetera. Because I think as you start to sort of explore, what are these different options out there of things that I could do, and would those find meaning? So I had a student a few years ago who decided that she was going to be a doctor, and she was really not very good at it. I mean, she was getting like D's and C's in all of her pre-med classes. And
sounds
I finally
familiar.
Said to her, do you, well, hey, for me too, that's why I'm not an actual doctor. And so eventually I said to her, listen, you know, why do you really want to do this doctor thing? Like, is this really, you know, what you want to do? Because she wasn't good at it and she wasn't liking it. You know, it wasn't like she was getting C's and D's and loving it. And she goes, well, I really want to be a doctor because I want to help people. And I was like, there's 100 ways you can help people.
Right.
I'm like, you could get a master's in social work. You could get a you know, doctorate of public health and you know, help people in a broad way in terms of health. You could become a nurse. You could, I mean, I kind of went through all these different ways in which you could help people. And she was like, okay, I'll think about it. And she came back to my office like 2 days later and she said, I'm going to be a history major. I love history. And
wow.
I was like, yeah, amazing, right?
Right, yeah.
And it was one of these things where I said to myself, oh my gosh, I should have said this like a year ago. Like, I mean, again, I didn't want to, like, you know, kill her dream. But her dream was just, I want to help people. And she had it in her mind that being a doctor was the noblest way to help people. And being a doctor, of course, is a way to help people. But there are a ton of ways that you can help people. And again, that was her dream. And so I think really thinking about what are the options and what am I good at and what do I love? And often those two things are highly correlated.
I really enjoyed that answer. Thank you.
It was a long answer. Sorry.
No worries at all. I really appreciate that. That story is pretty familiar. I know a friend of mine, she wanted to be a doctor as well. And she still wants to be a doctor, but in a different context. I think she went from studying pre-med to now traveling down the road into like world health and public health. So that's a pretty familiar story for a lot of people.
And that's a really great example, your friend, where studying public health and world health issues is a way to have a tremendous impact globally on helping people. And you may not think of that career. You may be like so focused on, you know, I've seen a doctor on TV or I've gone to my pediatrician or whatever. You know what that career is. And so doing that sort of exploration can be really helpful for people.
I know that your book, The Positive Shift, is more about self-love, but I want to ask a couple questions about romantic love and platonic love, if that's all right.
Of course.
So, one of the I guess modules of practicing self-love is setting realistic expectations, right?
Yes.
And in a romantic relationship, there is a lot of expectation. Where does one find the realism in their expectations? Because expectations, right, are, you know, what we expect, what we deem as a standard. So when do we know, how can we tell the difference between a natural expectation and a fantasy that we want, to create?
So I'm actually teaching a class right now on close relationships. So this is a topic that I, you know, spend a lot of time thinking and talking about. So I think the most important thing for people to remember is that close relationships are the best predictor of our happiness. So of all the different factors that lead to happiness, having good relationships that could be romantic, could be friendships, could be family relationships, et cetera, but having relationships in which we feel we can be our authentic selves, in which we can have meaningful conversations, that's the number one best predictor of our happiness. But here's the reality. Many people have unrealistic expectations about relationships. For example, people often think, well, if it's a good relationship, we'll never fight, or it will always be easy and it will always be effortless. And I think the key that people need to remember is that good relationships take time and energy and effort. They require being vulnerable, and they require fighting. They require compromise. And so having the expectation that, you know, true love is easy or, you know, magical or effortless is really, really hazardous. And I think we often get that from popular press, you know, the media, romantic comedies, you know, love at first sight, blah, blah, blah. And to have good relationships, you got to work at having good relationships. You got to be willing to prioritize spending time and energy and effort with that person and not expect it to just be simple and easy and magical.
That's very interesting. I noticed a lot growing up. I would watch romantic comedies, and I would know that it was fiction, right? But somewhere deep, there was a message in there that really seared itself into my brain. And we see all around us in my generation, my peers, we see all of these shortfalls from a romantic era, I think, that came before us, you know, in the media, what love was supposed to look like. And for a lot of the time, I think, with my generation specifically, with the rise of social media, with the rise of technology, or the innovations in technology, we're becoming more and more distant with each other. We don't know how to hold conversations as well as maybe our parents did, or even our older siblings. Do you think that will matter in the grand scheme of things, or do you think that human beings will have a natural inclination on how to love each other?
So I'm going to tell you about a study that's going to scare you.
Ooh. All right.
So this is like trigger warning.
Okay.
And I talk about this in the book, you know, in a little bit more detail, but this is what they did. They brought in college students and they said, we'd like you to have a get to know you conversation with a stranger. So somebody you didn't know at all. Mm. They put them in a private room and have them have a 15-minute conversation. So they did this with lots and lots of different college students, paired off in a room, a private conversation with a stranger for 15 minutes. In half of the cases, before the conversation started, the researcher took her cell phone and she turned it off and she put it on the table in between the two people. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then they went through and audio taped the quality of the conversation for the conversations that happened with the cell phone present and with the cell phone absent. That was the only difference. The cell phone is either there or it's not there. And remember, the cell phone is turned off. It's not going to ring. It's not going to vibrate. Right. And the cell phone belongs to the researcher. It doesn't even belong to the people having the conversation.
Right.
And what they found was that the presence of the cell phone turned off on the table led to a lower quality of conversation. Less intimate, less meaningful, less vulnerable.
Wow.
I actually...
Introduce yourself one second. I'm sorry.
Hi, Dr. Sanderson. Hi. I'm Nikki. I'm one of the DJs for BU in the Morning.
Nice to meet you.
I believe that it's actually not that hard for me to believe that study. Because I feel like even when you're just on a date with somebody, when your phone is sort of like in eyesight, you're kind of hoping that it'll tear your attention away from the person that you're with. So having it on the table, even if it's off and it's not going to ring, I think it does have a significant impact, actually.
So if you take the results of that study, now multiply it by all the conversations that we have in which our cell phones are out, right?
Yeah.
I can tell you right now that there are 4 cell phones on the table right now.
This is just an audio call, so I don't have insight. But that's what I mean, right?
Right. That's
And so when you said, are we just going to adjust to it and adapt to it or whatever, here's the reality. The reality would say, experimentally, scientifically, the presence of cell phones constantly in our lives disrupts our ability to fully focus on and pay attention to the person that you're interacting with right now.
Wow.
It's sort of not really that much of a shock to me, but
hearing
like physical data.
Data,
is
right.
Like, it's sort of like scary.
It is scary. Dr. Sanderson.
Well, that's why I started it by saying that I was going to terrify you all, because I know that telling that study to college students is like terrifying, because of course it's everywhere. And so here's the thing. I started by saying we know that close relationships are the best predictor of our happiness. Mm. Mm-hmm. And then we also know that the presence of cell phones everywhere disrupts people's ability to have the kind of deep, meaningful conversations that lead us to have these good relationships. That's the problem, right?
Right. Yeah. So with all that being said, Dr. Sanderson, are we doomed? Is there a way to connect on a deeper? I know this is, again, a very big question, but in my mind, you know, I a lot of people tell me I'm an old soul. I listen to older music. You know, my parents influenced me a lot growing up, obviously, but in more ways than my peers did. Right. So I tend to enjoy connecting with people more than I guess my peers. So what is that to say to those anomalies or outliers, those people who still have those desires for that genuine connection? What do you tell those people?
I think there's two things to do. One, I think we really need to put away the phones.
Okay.
So when you're having coffee with a friend, when you're on a date, when you're at the dinner table with your family, you know, over Thanksgiving, whatever, put away your phones. Because the reminder of the phone being physically there or turned on and in your pocket, but it's going to ring or it's going to vibrate, disrupts our ability to have those conversations. So one is very simple, put away the phone. The other thing, which we haven't exactly talked about yet, but I think is very related to the broader issue of technology, is that it's really important for people on social media to present their authentic selves as opposed to their carefully curated self-presentational selves. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm going to snap for that one.
All right, good. And I think that's one of the challenges is that when we talk about technology, of course we're talking about cell phones, but we're also talking about Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, you know, Snapchat and so on, in which many people are presenting idealized versions. You know, here's this fabulous, you know, meal I had, here's this really fun party I went to, you know, here are these roses I got for Valentine's Day. And it can lead us to feel actually pretty lonely because our own lives may have those good moments, but they also have plenty of moments that are not so good that we're not often putting on social media. And that can make people feel worse. And it can actually make them feel lonely because they think everyone else is having these really great lives and they're not able to share the difficulties or challenges or struggles or disappointments they're having.
Right.
They're so focused on presenting the perfection.
Mm-hmm. That goes to show a trend I heard a lot growing up about, you know, our different generations, Generation X, I think, or are we millennials? I have no idea.
Millennials,
right?
I think you're a millennial.
Okay.
I'm going to bet you're a millennial.
Okay. I've heard that we are like the narcissist generation and that with the with technology and social media, we present ourselves in this fashion and, you know, we want people to love us. We want people to adore us and follow us and be our followers. But my question is it because we want people to follow us and we have a thing to say, or are we empty inside and we need the validation? You know,
and it's such an interesting question because here's the key. There's a difference between, and this is a really important point, there's a difference between wanting people to love you and follow you and respect you for who you really are versus who you're presenting.
Mm-hmm.
See the distinction?
Yes.
And that's one of the problems, is that do we want people to love us? Yes. But we want people to love us for who we actually are. Because otherwise, it's actually very threatening. I mean, you use the word empty. So if people love me because I have this perfect life, and then somebody finds out that I don't have a perfect life, maybe they don't actually love me. Because maybe they only loved me because I was really attractive and really, you know, funny and really perfect and really smart and really accomplished. And if they find out that my life isn't perfect, maybe they won't really love me. And that's terrifying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
And so that's a distinction. I have a friend, not a close friend, but, you know, somebody I went to high school with, which for me was a long time ago. And he posted on Facebook sometime in January, he posted a link to a Washington Post article, and the article was on being estranged from family members. And he posted the article on Facebook, and he wrote, "I've been estranged with my dad for five years, and it's really hard for me to talk about, and I haven't shared it before, but this article just really spoke to me, and so I wanted to, you know, share it with all of you in case it's helpful to somebody else."
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that gutsy?
Yeah.
Super.
Yeah.
Super.
Super, right? So he posted on Facebook, "I'm estranged from my dad." And so many people responded and were like, "I'm estranged from my mom. My brother's been estranged and I haven't been able to understand that this was really helpful to me. I'm so sorry for, you know, the experience. Thank you." And it was like this overwhelming sense of, nobody was like, "Oh, I really don't like him anymore. He doesn't, you know, get along with his dad."
Mm.
It was this sense of he was being who he really is.
Mm.
And that feels so powerful.
Hmm. Just to play a little bit of devil's advocate, right?
Sure.
What do you say to the person that is being rejected by their community when they are showing their authentic selves? Mm-hmm. Where does one find the courage to continue to do something like that and not succumb to the pressures of the people around them?
Well, so I think if a person is being their authentic selves and is being rejected by their friendship group, they need better friends.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's what I think, right?
Yes, that's perfectly honest, yes.
I mean, I think, because here's the thing, no one has a perfect life. No one has a perfect life. So if people only like you because they think you're, you know, really smart or really rich or really pretty or whatever, those are not your real friends. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to recognize that when we talk about people who are really in our corner, it's people who are in our corner for who we actually are, not for who we pretend to be on social media.
Okay. Definitely. Another question that I had that is a little bit on the devil's advocate side is what do you think is the difference between a self-love and a selfishness? Though I think, you know, in my mind, it is not hard for me to attach the two, mm-hmm. where on mm-hmm. one side, self-love can be perceived as, you know, not calling a certain individual back because in their mind, that individual is maybe toxic to their life. But in that mm-hmm. in that other mm-hmm. person's perception, it's like, why aren't you calling me back? You're being selfish. You're being, you know, mm-hmm. you know, blase. So where do you find that line?
So I think that there are two really distinct concepts, because self-love is really about taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm. So what we often see is people say, you know, I mean, you gave the example of, well, I have to keep calling this person back, or I have to spend time with them, even though I know that after I spend time with them, I feel worse about myself. You know, I feel worse about myself. I feel, you know, bad. People who say, you know what? I did poorly on something and I'm going to beat myself up about it. So a student who, you know, gets a bad grade on an exam or gets rejected from an internship or a job they wanted beats themselves up about it. Instead of saying, I'm going to treat myself with self-compassion. It's going to be okay. You're going to find another job. Take care of yourself. Or feeling, hey, I don't have a date on Valentine's Day. I could sit around and mope about it, or I could show myself some self-compassion and say, you know what, I'm going to get a pedicure, or I'm going to go to a really funny movie, or I'm going right. to, you know, go out with a bunch of friends and celebrate, you know, Valentine's Day, or, you know, whatever it is. And I think the idea of self-love is taking care of yourself. When you know that you are feeling sad or stressed or lonely, taking care of yourself and doing what makes you feel better is really important. What we know, in fact, is that one of the best ways to feel better about yourself is to do things for other people. Hmm. The research shows that volunteering makes people feel happier, donating money to charity makes people feel happier, doing random acts of kindness makes people feel happier. So we actually know that, in fact, the opposite of selfish behavior makes people feel better. Doing things for other people makes us feel better, as long as they are motivated by a genuine desire to do that, not out of, you know, obligation or force. Yeah. And so it's really important to do things for other people. It's also really important to treat yourself with kindness.
Totally.
I like that. That you actually enlightened me because, you know, and... Yeah, I can be a bit of a pessimist sometimes. In my head, I attach certain values to a word that I guess I'm not necessarily correct on. With that answer, I'm thinking a little differently about what self-love means, and how I can show it.
Good.
Yeah.
I love to hear that.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. One concept that I really want to dig into is the practicing gratitude, you know, acknowledging what you have, and working with what you got. This is another one of those pessimistic thoughts. Do you think that is settling for, or do you think that, how do you feel about that? I mean, not even how you feel, but, you know, what do you say to that? Is that settling to you?
Well, so I think focusing on gratitude is really about thinking about what is good in your life right now. So it doesn't mean that you don't have ambition or goals or, you know, future plans or dreams. Here's the key. How many of you guys are in the room right now?
Four.
Four of you. Okay. So I'm gonna ask a question. You're gonna have to tell me honestly, since I can't see you.
Okay.
How many of you four go to sleep at night thinking about the problems you're facing and your to-do list and the stuff that you've got to accomplish in the next few days or problems you're having? Raise your hand if that describes you.
All of us are raising our hands. Every single
one. Okay, there you go. So you're 100% of people are doing that, okay? Now, guess what it makes it hard for people to get a good night's sleep after doing?
Stressful.
That. Okay?
Right.
That, it's weird. But thinking, going to sleep at night thinking about, oh, these things are rotten and bad and I got to make sure I have this and I've got this interview and I've got this problem set and whatever, it leads people to not be able to sleep well, and it's just negative and it's not productive. So the idea of focusing on gratitude is to do something different. Focus on something that is good in your life right now. And that's the key. It has to be right now. It can't be, this will be good once I, you know, win the lottery, once I graduate from college, once I buy a house, once I get married, once I have a date, you know, whatever it is. Things that you're grateful for right this second. And it could be something like, you know what? I'm really grateful that I had that, you know, fun time with a friend bowling last weekend. I'm really grateful that it snowed tonight because it was so pretty outside as I walked, you know, back to class. So things that you are grateful for in your life, write that exact second and write those down and think about those before you go to bed or when you first wake up in the morning. And that's an example of not saying I don't have goals or ambitions or, you know, things I'm going to work towards, but it means recognizing that we all have good things in our lives every single day.
Wow. You're really giving me the keys to success here. I really appreciate that. We all really appreciate this.
Really helpful.
I want to open it up to my fellow DJs. Do you have any questions for Dr. Sanderson?
So going back to the topic of social media and how it can sort of like influence our...
Hey, I need you to talk a teeny bit louder. I'm having more trouble hearing you. Just get closer to the mic. I want to make sure I'm getting the whole question. Yeah.
Is this good?
Yeah, that's better. Thanks.
Awesome. So going back to social media and the whole idea of how it can influence us and how we see ourselves and how we see other people, do you think it's possible to change who and what you follow on social media so that you're not as stressed about what somebody's actually doing and how their life is, quote unquote, better than mine? Do you think that's possible? In a way?
Yes, I do think it's possible, and I think there's three things. Mm-hmm. One, if there are people who drive you nuts on social media, stop following them.
I'm gonna snap to that because
sometimes people have a person they're like, I can't, and so if there are people who are triggers for you, mm-hmm. just stop following them. Just get just done. So that's one. Two, have a recognition. Mm-hmm. They can be posting these wonderful, great things, but it doesn't mean it's their whole life. So sort of making that distinction between, we often look at other people's social media and we're like, this is a complete autobiographical rendition of their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It's, you know, it's the wonderful vacation photo. It's not the vacation photo when, you know, nobody showered for 3 days and their car got a ticket.
Right.
And, you know, they're, you know, really miserable and, you know, their clothes are dirty, you know. And so recognizing that difference. And then three, use social media to be your authentic self.
Yeah.
Here's an example that I describe in the book. So my mother died a number of years ago, about 15 years ago now, and I used to dread social media on Mother's Day because it was, you know, this day of everybody posting pictures of taking their mom to brunch and, you know, best mom ever, hashtag, you know, whatever. And I felt horrible. I mean, I would really, really miss my mom that day. And what I started doing is every Mother's Day, I post a picture of me and my mom, and I say, I'm really sad. I miss my mom today. And then I would tag everybody who I knew who'd also had their mother die.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, sadly, that's more people every single year. But so I would tag all those people, and the number of people who said to me, oh my gosh, I was feeling so sad today, and then I saw your post, and you remembered, and I felt so much better. And so I think part of it is that there's an example of, we think about social media as a time to get support and celebration, but we can also use it as a time to give support to people who are struggling in some way, who the day may be hard for.
Yeah.
And I think that's about, again, not just presenting the good, but presenting times in which we feel sad or scared or rejected or lonely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I connect with that on a real level. And I've always had problems with my relationship with my mother, and she passed away in 2017. So it's sort of like extra hard for me on that day.
Right.
But I've been like trying to do that, and I try to stay off social media on that day because it's a hard day for me. But I've been trying to do that also, and like make sure that people understand I'm not always smiling. I'm not always like, my face isn't always beat with makeup. My hair isn't always done. I try to like sort of do that because I know that there are other people watching who may not know that this isn't always my life. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sorry about your mom. And I'm sorry that you also had a difficult relationship, you know, before, because that does make it especially hard. And so Mother's Day, probably for the rest of your life, you want to engage in some real self-compassion.
Yeah.
And you want to spend it with people who know you and get you and love you, and you want to spend it taking care of yourself.
Yes, thank you.
This has been an amazing interview. We have about 8 minutes left in our showtime, so I want to thank you, Dr. Sanderson, for having this interview with us, enlightening us on self-love and love in general. I don't know when your book is coming out, but you can plug that.
Yes.
The book is out now.
The book is
out now. You can get it anywhere, and it's called The Positive Shift. And if anybody wants to read more about my work, or I have some videos you can watch, etc., I have a website, which is sandersonspeaking.com, and that gives information about my talks and my book, etc. So sandersonspeaking.com and The Positive Shift. And if you like this interview, there's much more in the book. We talk about all of these things, and I give some real sort of practical suggestions as well. So thank you for the time and the opportunity to plug. And you all have a wonderful rest of your day. Stay warm.
Thank you very much. All right.
Take care. Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you as well. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.